And our guest tonight, Charles R. Smith. Andrew from Lafayette, Indiana, sends me a quick message. George, I wanted to comment on China. My wife was born and raised in Beijing, and I have come to love the people in the place. I think we have more to worry about from them economically. As long as they're prospering more and more, I believe they will be happy. Well, Andrew, you are right. They are wonderful people. But my concern, and I'm sure Charles Smith's concern, is with those people who would use their tanks to run over and crush their own people. You remember that? You can't forget that. Back in a moment. Charles, roughly how many people truly run the Chinese government? They're in charge. They're doing whatever they want.
Probably no more than about 1,000.
That's it. The whole country.
Whole country.
And all of them must be very, very wealthy people by now.
Oh, extremely wealthy. You know, in a nation where slave labor is prevalent, it is not unusual for them to line their pockets, to have Swiss bank accounts, throw lavish parties and have foreign luxury automobiles. And the kick to this is, I didn't say that. That's actually in the Rand Corporation report from 1997 on the Chinese defense industry. And it made very clear that most of the Chinese generals have exactly that, Swiss bank accounts, foreign luxury automobiles. They throw lavish parties.
They travel. I'm sure they're very rarely in their own country, I bet.
They send their sons and daughters to the United States to be educated. You'll find, you know, I guess the ultimate insult in many cases, they like a lot of American products. They buy real American stuff.
And bring it back.
They love
the tag made in USA.
Huh? Oh, yeah. You know, that's sort of the insult, the injury. You know, the kick to this is that, you know, I and others do not oppose the Chinese people. In fact, I actually feel for them. They're victims like everyone else in this. They are the biggest victim, to be honest with you, to date.
Well, how do 1,000 people take control of a country? How do they do this?
They have a single party rule, the CCP, the Central Communist Party, and the PLA headquarters staff are the guys that actually run the whole country. It's a very limited number of people involved in this. And, you know, I'm being kind of liberal with the word 1,000 here. The PLA, through their strong arm, the People's Armed Police, will throw anyone in jail who has any sort of opposition.
So if you can control police, control military, you've got it.
Control the media.
Yep.
You control literally every day, every waking hour. You have informants right down at the street level that work consistently to make sure that everybody is thinking the right way. And if they make a statement that's out of line, well, you know, we have a Lao Gai camp just around the block waiting for you, Lao Gai being their concentration camps. And unfortunately, we here in the United States cooperate with this in that in many cases, the wonderful goods that we have on sale here at Christmas are actually manufactured by prisoners of conscience, people who are political prisoners in slave labor camps, make many of the toys that are for sale here in the United States.
Charles, this whole episode with China, the partnership, the trading, let's take a step back here and take a look at what they're doing worldwide, first of all. I definitely want to talk with you about their space initiative and their plans to go to the moon and whether you think they're going to beat us at our own game. But what's going on, first of all, with Taiwan? And I say that because I'm not so sure if they marched into Taiwan tomorrow, we're going to do much about it. I just don't think we're spread so thin because of Iraq and other areas on this planet. I don't think there's anything we can do aside from threaten to drop a new bomb, and they've already said through their crazy general they're prepared to take a lot of hits.
Well, you know, here's some of the factors that go behind this. First, mutually assured destruction, the old Cold War balance of terror, does not work with the Chinese military and the Chinese leadership. They are perfectly willing to sacrifice one-third, one-half of their own population. Not a problem. That's people, peasants out in the field. Who cares if they live or die? They don't. So, losing 500, 600 million people really wouldn't make them cry very much.
Yeah, but the contamination, the new contamination.
Well, as long as I've got my Swiss bank account and mm-hmm. my vacation home in Monaco, what do I care?
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Once again, the Chinese people will take the brunt of any such strike by the United States. And our leadership is fully aware of that, that threatening the Chinese cities with their massive retaliation. You know, let's say the Chinese decide to take out Los Angeles as part of a coordinated strike against Hawaii, Guam, Okinawa, and Taiwan. If we retaliate by taking out their top 10 cities, that's not going to hurt them.
They don't care.
They don't care. Okay, again, the Chinese people are their victims. They don't care. So our military has made it very clear quietly to their military and to their political leadership that we may not go with the mutually assured destruction theme. We may do what's called precision targeting, which is what we tried to do with Saddam Hussein.
And take out those people.
Those people. That means that you personally, you, your family, your pet, your goldfish, your front yard, your house in Monaco, all of that is now on the target list.
Yeah, that's fair game.
Okay. That makes you think a little bit mm-hmm. as compared to, you know, I can hunker down in my bunker this week and throw 100 million people out. Who cares?
Wasn't that the old Russian formula?
Kind of, yes. Now, the Taiwan issue, if they stepped off on Taiwan, it would not just involve the United States. Japan, for example, imports all of their energy, all of their foreign-based oil from the Middle East through Taiwanese waters. Japan has extremely close military and diplomatic relationship with Taiwan. In fact, Taiwan, technically speaking, has a better relationship with Tokyo than with Beijing because they actually used to be part of the Japanese Empire mm-hmm. for quite some time. A step off on Taiwan would essentially cut off the supply or lines of communication for Japan. So a step off on Taiwan would automatically invoke treaties as well as economic reality to Tokyo, and it would start a war between the two. Believe me, we've already had plenty of bump and rub over the past couple of years between Tokyo and Beijing, including China sending a nuclear submarine into Japanese territorial waters. Technically speaking, that is an act of war.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese self-defense forces have essentially defended their airspace more than 30 times this year alone.
Any shootdowns?
No shootdowns. We're talking about Chinese long-range surveillance aircraft coming into the warning zones. They have not incurred into Japanese airspace, but that's only because they knew that the fighters were scrambled and coming up after them. They turned around and went away. This is the same kind of game that we played with the Russians during the Cold War. There were plenty of bear bombers off our coast. It doesn't happen much these days, but the Japanese know about it, are acutely aware of the problem. They used to have a lot of incursions by the Russians on their northern borders. That doesn't happen very often now. It's all China. And, you know, they have this little competition over a very large gas and oil field that sort of straddles the sea between them. Japan is invoking the international treaties, which say that the demarcation line runs directly the halfway point between two countries.
Now, you don't think there's any way Japan could battle China and win without our help?
At the moment, the Japanese do not have nuclear weapons.
Right.
If they so desired, in about 20 months, they could have an arsenal of 200 to 300 weapons, extremely advanced weapons, in some cases probably better than what we have. The Japanese, if they so desired, could take China. But at the moment, they're not exactly happy at the idea because of what happened in 1945 to them. They're not exactly happy because they know that China is doing this on purpose. This is China playing the Japan card. Japan is not exactly well-liked in the region, both North and South Korea. If you ask them, the South Koreans, who their number one enemy is, they probably won't say Kim Jong-il. They'd probably say Tokyo.
Really?
Well, you know, let's put it this way. If you find a tree in Korea, it had to have been grown after 1945 because literally every tree, north and south, was cut down by Imperial Japan.
Right.
There's not a lot of love lost, okay? There isn't any really warm feeling here. Now,
And of course, we know the Chinese, based on the Japanese atrocities of World War II, there's no love lost there either.
Absolutely. But as I point out quite clearly, this is a previous generation that we're dealing with. The key to this is that China knows, the Chinese military and the leadership knows, that if they don't give a foreign threat to their people are going to start thinking about little things like liberty, free speech, freedom of religion, you know, minor little ideas like that. So instead, by building up America and Japan as these evil outsiders who want to conquer China, you have this nationalistic theme. That's why Taiwan is so important to the Beijing leadership. The return to the motherland, and that's an exact quote. The Chinese military has made it very clear that they want Taiwan to return to the motherland, even if they have to kill every last Taiwanese citizen to do it.
Now, and they seem to be more concerned, though, about any referendum or vote, you know, for the so-called, you know, freedom, we're on our own, as opposed to just basically simply leaving status quo.
Well, the Chinese government knows full well that the success of Taiwanese democracy, as well as the success of the Taiwanese economy, have been a big thorn in their side. For such a little itty-bitty island, they produce a good-sized chunk in comparison to even China of income. And they also realize that having free speech and freedom of religion and other voting liberties, that's a problem for the Chinese CCP. They don't particularly want another party. To be honest with you, if you form a political party on the mainland, that is considered an act punishable by death and has been enforced recently. So, you know, in Taiwan, on the other hand, but just like here in the United States, forming a political party, that's a weekly affair by a bunch of people who get together in an apartment, okay? You know, it's not a deal. Here in the United States, forming a political party, you just get two people together, you've got a political party. Therein lies the biggest problem for Beijing.
But I think, and you tell me if you think the same, I think if anything ever happens with Taiwan, it'll be one of those overnight things. I mean, we're going to just wake up one morning and find out China sent 2 million troops, 15 ships, and they've taken over.
Something like that doesn't happen suddenly. I know that that sounds hard to believe, but in the world of reconnaissance satellites, aircraft, listening posts, something like that is telegraphed very easily.
So you'll see movement first.
You'll see movement, you'll see troops, you'll see landing craft, you'll see warships.
Will there be missile launches first?
That'll probably be in the leading edge of this.
Yeah.
We would actually see and know full well. One of the things that the Chinese leadership doesn't trust is their own military. This is a fact.
They don't. What do you mean? Why?
Well, because if you happen to have enough power, you could probably try to take over.
That's true.
It's a classic dictatorship problem.
So maybe they want to be part of the thousand. Huh?
Well, Well, you know, exactly. And if you're an aspiring Chinese general and you're on the outside of Beijing, not making quite as much money as the guys inside.
Yeah, you don't have your Swiss account yet, let's say.
And you happen to have control of a missile and a warhead, you've got your own little country, okay? You can say dictate terms, so to speak.
Could this happen?
Yes. They could stage an election. There can be a civil war in China. It's very dicey. The Chinese government has a secure clamp on information flow coming out, but there were something on the order of 60,000 separate riots just last year. We're talking about more than 1,000 people getting into the streets, burning things, breaking up stuff. I mean, equivalent of the Paris riots recently.
How could the Soviet Union fall and chop itself up into its countries, and China basically stays intact? How come that regime doesn't collapse?
Well, when you bring in an airborne division backed by tanks and you roll the tanks over protesters, it sort of dampens the enthusiasm of your opposition.
And the Soviets weren't in a position to do that.
The Soviets weren't so willing to run over protesters with their own tanks. In many cases, the individuals in the tanks were not willing to do so. Got to remember, in the case of the Chinese, when they brought in the division and the armor, that came from outside of Beijing, so there were no relatives.
Mm-hmm.
They did that on purpose. The theme that they've played has been this economic thing. Well, you know, buying your own toothpaste to making your own decision about what toothpaste you're going to buy is not democracy. The key to that is that we here in the West have cooperated. We call this engagement. This is this economic theme. We brought you mentioned this earlier. As long as they are prosperous, they'll be happy. If they get happy, then we'll all live together as happy capitalists and nobody will have any problems. Well, they haven't been any less repressive or any less belligerent, even though they've got plenty of money. The reality is they've grown more belligerent and more oppressive internally as they've acquired more funding.
And I think that's going to get worse.
Yeah. The Chinese government has morphed from a classic communist society into what we now know as a Nazi or National Socialist Society. They believe in free ownership as long as it's them that's doing the ownership.
Mm-hmm.
They believe in capitalism as long as it's them that they can set up the companies
so
and reap the benefits.
They could nationalize all these U.S. companies that think they're cutting deals over there. They could be nationalized at any time, couldn't they?
There's a lot worse they can do than just that, and they already do it. The head of GM China was fired recently for a very good reason. He helped set up a couple of factories in China to produce cars in the hopes, of course, of selling GM cars to Chinese citizens.
Sounds good, right?
Right. Sounds like a real great idea. Well, guess what? There's no market. Duh. Okay. So what are the Chinese doing? They're manufacturing cars for export to compete against GM on the Asian market. So what does GM have to do in the end? They fire the guy who was in charge of the whole deal because he didn't have the foresight to see exactly what was going on. This is a classic case. I can cite example after example, company after company that's done the same thing. They go over, they help them set up, they help them modernize and industrialize, and then suddenly they find they have a competitor, not a partner.
So the Chinese don't take over that plant. They just go and build a better one.
Precisely.
Okay.
You know, what they'll do is they'll take an antiquated factory, they'll plow it under, they'll bring over American computer-aided manufacturing, mm-hmm. computer-aided design, they bring over the engineers, the software. They may, in some cases, bring over an American plant piecemeal and rebuild it over there. And I don't know how many American companies, from Alcoa to McDonnell Douglas and others, have done that. They've literally taken whole factories and facilities and moved them to China, set them up over there, fired all the Americans eventually. And then, of course, as they've discovered, instead of becoming partners, they now find their competitors. One of the things that...
Well, hold that, Charles, because I also want to ask you, maybe there's some kind of deal here between these governmental leaders and some of these huge corporate bigwigs, where they'll be okay if there's any kind of a takeover. Back in a moment. And our guest is Charles Smith. Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. I know those of you who are calling right now, just hold off right now, and we'll open up the lines in about 30 minutes. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Charles Smith, Charles, you were saying one more thing and then the clock got us. Did you want to pick up from there or go right to my next question?
All right, let's go on to your next question.
Okay. The Illuminati, this group out there of the few that are trying to control everything, is it possible? Because I'm trying to come up with a theory that we're one of the biggest customers of China. Do they really want to go to war with us? Do we want to go to war with them? What if there's a group of people out there who all they care about is themselves, be it the 1,000 Chinese and who knows how many in this country, and all they really care about is whatever deals they cut with each other. And then if there's a problem, if there's a war, so be it, as long as they're protected. Is that possible?
Well, yeah, but the problem with modern warfare is it can happen anywhere, anytime, and it could be global. And it certainly won't be good for their bank accounts or their vacation homes, or, you know, even if they are lounging on the beach in Monaco and it never gets drawn into it, something it could eventually happen. I mean, you know, we had this kind of theme with World War One and World War Two. Well, the end of the Second World War, things changed. They called it the atomic bomb, the great equalizer. Our weapon systems globally have gone beyond our capability mentally and socially to deal with them. The H-bomb came at the end of a generation who, you know, the biggest thing they'd seen was a battleship gun.
And that's 60-year-old technology.
Correct. Now, what caused the world to stand on top of its head is that the generals, the leaders, the industrialists, the politicians, the kings, the queens, suddenly found themselves in the same foxhole with the rest of us. They became just as much a viable target as the rest of us. And this technology isn't going away. It's actually getting more advanced. You don't necessarily need to use a nuclear weapon. We can now hunt you globally, as we have done with Saddam Hussein, as we're doing with Osama bin Laden. You can hang out in the hills of Afghanistan. But if you show your face anywhere, you never can tell. You might be in the crosshairs of a laser-guided bomb. It might be a predator up there with a Hellfire missile watching you via satellite. It doesn't necessarily even have to be a man, so to speak.
Right.
It's hunting you now. These weapons are going to get smaller, more accurate, and just as lethal. Some of the technologies that I've written about take me back to projects. In the 1960s, there was a nice science fiction short story called Hellhound, and it was about a miniature unmanned aerial vehicle about the size of a fly that was an assassin's weapon. Well, we're getting to the point now where that kind of technology is on the edge of being deployed. We have a miniature RPV that is currently flying. It's about 3, maybe 5 inches long. It is a silent propulsion system. It does not have any energy source on board. It's actually flying utilizing the microwave energy being beamed at it from a distant source. It is very small. There are versions that are being evaluated that are flappers, as well as, you know, the traditional fan kind of engine size.
How high up is it?
We're talking about something that can be deployed personally down here on the ground in a building, in a yard, with a 3 to 5 mile range, maybe a little bit more.
And it just, I mean, does it fly, or how does it move?
It flies.
Jeez.
And as I pointed out, it's virtually silent. It obviously is being used currently as a testbed for a surveillance system, but it's just as easy to, you know, make them go from an unmanned surveillance system to a combat vehicle, as we have seen Predator go from being a small flying unmanned aircraft to a small flying armed unmanned aircraft. And small weapons can be developed and deployed with these systems to make them personally lethal. So, you know, this is a whole new world that we're living in. So any industrialist, any would-be engineer, anyone who feels that they would be invulnerable no matter where they are, is silly. They're living in a pipe dream. I'm afraid technology has caught us up to the point now where hunting an individual is the game, and that's where we're spending a large amount of money on R&D to make it better, faster, and easier. We're making war personal now. It's not business, of course. It's personal. And that's what we're telling some of these leadership, such as the leadership of the PLA. Okay, you know, who cares if you say, we'll have a nuclear exchange, I'll lose 500 million people, you'll lose 150 to 200, but your country is devastated, we'll keep on going. And our response to that is, no, we're not going to flatten your cities or kill, you know, hundreds of millions of people.
Innocent people.
Right. We're going to come after you personally.
And we know where you are.
We'll find you, even if we don't.
And if you think this message,
daylight, we'll catch you.
You think this message has truly been conveyed?
In a way, yes, but I'm not sure they believe it yet, even after the demonstrations. That's one of the things that there is a great deal of concern. Many cases, when we talk to the Chinese government and they talk to us about these things, we're not talking to each other as much as at each other. That's how we got involved with them in Korea. We didn't believe what they were saying. They didn't believe what we were saying. Americans are very arrogant in our firm belief that we have, that our technology is so superior nobody would take us on. Well, the Korean War, the Chinese showed us otherwise. They were flying the MiG-15, which was the most advanced jet fighter in, of its time.
Well, and
much better than what we had.
And recently, we have not fought countries who have some technology to test us. You know, Iraq didn't have anything.
Well, you can imagine that the Iraqi Air Force would run and hide and bury its airplanes.
Well, they're the insurgents now.
Right. The flip side of that is you can also imagine that the Chinese with 4,000 combat aircraft are going to throw everything they've got, and these guys are not going to turn around and run. They're going to either get shot down or kill you.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Okay. That's the way they operate. They have a whole different style, a whole different mental set. And as I pointed out before, one of the things that we have to understand about dictatorships is they fight differently than we do, and we need to take advantage of that. The Chinese missile forces, for example, we know when these guys are getting serious, and we don't necessarily have to do it by either watching them. We just listen to them. We know when they move the Politburo troops along with their missiles, now we've got a problem.
I see.
The reason for that is their missile warheads are taken off and stored in a separate location and guarded by the Politburo troops.
So if they start moving with the warheads, look out.
Right. If they pull the warheads out and the Politburo troops go to the missile bases with the warheads and start bolting them on, then we know that there's something going on.
Well, are we going to let that happen?
We may not. But then again, we may not have a choice, because a good example is the recent espionage case, again in Los Angeles, of Chinese-born naturalized American who has leaked some of the most advanced technology that we had to them, the Aegis battle management systems. This is a terrific threat, because this is the espionage involved there is not a strategic or a political. This is tactical weapon systems and employment, usage, and countering. This is the kind of stuff that you would do as a preliminary to war. The bottom line is that the kind of information that they found may endanger things like our F-117, the B-2, our Aegis warships, our carriers. They also leaked silent propulsion system technology, as well as how to track American submarines. That's not a nice thing to do. And our problem here in America, being a free society, is that we're also a politically correct society. So We don't enforce things like if you've been communicating with your relatives back in China, we need to polygraph you if you want to retain your clearance.
Well, what's the trigger, Charles, if there's going to be a war between the two nations? What's going to be the trigger to make this happen? What happens? Give me a scenario. And a scenario that you believe, truly believe, will be the catalyst for a war.
Well, the instigation may actually come external to the United States and internal to China. At some point, the Chinese leadership, because of the unrest within their own country, is going to feel that they have no alternative but to start a war to retain their popularity and their power. This is the same theme that General Galtieri picked up when he invaded the Falklands in 1982. His regime was extremely unpopular and extremely brutal to the people. But as soon as he stepped off on the Falklands, he suddenly became a hero and loved. So think of the 2008 Olympics as a setting of like 1936. That's exactly the kind of parallel that we're looking at here. At some point, the Chinese leadership is going to see that the stability in their own regime requires that they step off on something. Otherwise, the people will begin to think too much about their own lives. So, Taiwan would be a perfect place. After 2008 is a good time because they'll have more than 1,000 ballistic missiles. They'll have enough landing craft. They'll have enough heavy air transport. It is the kind of window of opportunity if they've got the kind of tactical information that says they can defeat the U.S. Navy. And this is where, again, we get into the theme of where we are today and where we'll be in the near future. Granted, we have a lot of ground troops involved in Iraq, but we don't have five carrier battle groups in the Middle East anymore because we don't need them. We don't have 500 combat aircraft in the Middle East anymore because we don't need them. They're in the Pacific region. We are now basing an aircraft carrier in Hawaii. We will base a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier in Japan. All of these things, essentially, we've moved forward a B-2 bomber to Guam as a forwarding and staging point. We also have B-1s out there. We've moved some forces, shifted these highly tactical and technical systems that were extremely expensive to maintain from the Middle East to the Asian theater. Now, keeping 100,000 and 150,000 troops on the ground in Iraq is not exactly an inexpensive kind of operation. But for the past, during the 1990s, that whole decade, we were spending $25, $30 billion a year maintaining 3 to 5 battle groups and 500 to 600 combat aircraft in that region. That's a lot of firepower. And the Pacific War will be mainly sea power and air power. It will not be as much a land engagement. Us tangling, squaring off on the land engagement against the Chinese is really kind of a stupid thing to do. And we know it, and they know it. On the other hand, sitting out there and blasting their command post and their generals personally might be a nice way of putting their armed forces into such disarray that they become sitting ducks.
Am I being naive where I don't believe there's going to be a war? I think it's going to be all economics.
No, that's part of the war. The objective here is to weaken the United States, how to win a war without shooting. That was the Sun Tzu policy. The best war that you've ever fight is the one that you don't have to fight. And one way to take over somebody is to buy them out. And that's essentially one of the aims or prospects here is as they gain more money by this economic imbalance, they will come back to the U.S. and buy major corporations, by political influence, and so don't be surprised if the next company they aim at has some major defense industry involved.
Well, here's another situation, too. Here's General Motors limping along, stock depressed. They were even contemplating bankruptcy. The president says General Motors said today, no, it's not going to happen. But that's a prime takeover for a country like China.
Correct. And at the same time, you have to understand that even the technology that GM possesses could be dangerous. Chrysler did a deal in China in the 1990s to produce the Jeep Cherokee. They went to the BJ Corporation, which is actually wholly owned by the Chinese Army.
Which is a great car, by the way. I used to have one a long time
ago.
Well,
you know, the Chinese BJ Corporation makes the BJ 2020, which is essentially the Chinese Army Jeep.
Is that like a Humvee?
I'll get to that in just a second.
All right.
Chrysler cuts this wonderful deal to manufacture the Cherokees. The Chinese start manufacturing the Cherokees, so they say, we would like to get more advanced technology to manufacture a van. The Chrysler executives go over to Beijing, and they see Jeep Cherokees driving around that don't have Chrysler markings on them. So they inquire, and they find out these are counterfeit copies being produced by the manufacturer over there and sold illegally.
Perfect duplicates.
Right. So they confront the Chinese general running the corporation and say, you know, what are you doing? You're selling counterfeit copies. And his response was, well, you should be happy because our technology has advanced to the point where we can make good counterfeit copies.
Maybe even better?
Well, it gets better. They were seeking the kind of technology from Chrysler for advanced CAD, CAM, and robotic manufacturing that was applicable at that time to Chrysler manufacturing Humvees and Chrysler manufacturing the M1 Abrams tank. If you recall, Chrysler used to be the manufacturer
right
there. Well, the Chrysler executives recognized the technology that they were requesting was a little bit more advanced than just producing a van, and of course the copycatting caused them to walk away from the deal. Well, the BJ Corporation at least managed to obtain enough technology and enough sales from their knockoffs of the Jeep Cherokees to now have manufactured their replacement for the BJ 2020, which is a Humvee version, uprated, and it will become the standard driving vehicle for the Chinese Army, which is called the BJX. And it is now, I've got some real nice pictures across the web from some of my informants inside who've shown me, and because they know that I've written about the BJ Corporation and their wonderful operations. And of course, you know, we have to look at it in light from our point of view. We gave them the technology, we allowed them to sell the stuff, and we can thank the Chrysler Corporation for helping out with the Chinese Army need for a replacement for their four-wheel drive vehicle with the new Humvee version.
How much of this country in terms of real estate do they own?
Not much. They've taken a lesson from the Japanese, who attempted to buy real estate during the 80s with the money that they had.
Oh, and they bought everything they could find.
Right, and they ended up losing their shirt because the real estate market went down through the tubes, and they ended up having to sell at a loss in many cases.
Isn't that one of the reasons why the Japanese Nikkei market, stock market, just almost collapsed?
One of the reasons. So it's more, a lot more domestically oriented because the Chinese financial and banking industry is extremely closed, and that causes major problems. You can't lower your interest rates beyond zero, okay?
I wish we could.
Well, you know, they call it pushing on a string. Lowering interest rates is kind of like a string. You let out a piece of string, and hopefully there'll be somebody to tug at the other end, which brings everybody up in the economic growth. Well, if the kite, i.e. the consumer at the other end of the string, isn't tugging and you let out, it's like pushing on a piece of string. All you're doing is you're just unraveling all over the ground. And that's what happened to the Japanese economy.
Charles, when we come back, let's talk a little bit more about China. I've got several more questions for you. But we'll also open up the phone lines because you have many questions. For Charles Smith, I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.